Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Today is November the 14th. This year's just screaming by. So I hope you are doing well. A week from today, we are all going to be hopefully preparing for Thanksgiving. Like, we will have already been to the grocery store. I end up at the grocery store oftentimes on the day before Thanksgiving. And so let me attest to the fact that's just not a good idea. So let's all plan ahead. And it's a week away. I can hardly believe that. And so there you go. I'm already giving thanks. I'm going to lead off with, frankly, a horribly tragic story yesterday out of Chicago. If you have not yet heard, a police officer shot and killed a black security guard who had successfully subdued a gunman who had opened fire at a bar. So the lead on CNN is this: suburban Chicago security guard was killed by police while doing his job. The paragraph or the lead sentence is: a suburban Chicago police officer responding to a shooting Sunday at a bar killed a security guard who was just doing his job. The officer from Midlothian, Illinois, fatally shot Jamel Roberson, 26-year-old security guard who was working at the bar, the Cook County Sheriff's spokesperson, Sophia Ansari, told CNN. So let me brief you in on this in case you're not up to speed. When police arrived after reports of a shooting at a bar outside of Chicago, witnesses say that Jamel Roberson, the security guard who worked there, had already subdued the alleged assailant and had pinned him to the ground. Adam Harris, who is a person who told WGN-TV that he was at the bar at the time of the incident, he said that Roberson was holding the assailant on the ground with his knee in his back, and his gun also in his back when officers from neighboring Midlothian got there early Sunday. Roberson was wearing his security uniform and a hat that said security, and was fatally shot and killed by a police officer. Roberson was declared dead shortly after arriving at a hospital. Four others at the bar, including the shooting suspect, this is from a CNN report, sustained non-life-threatening injuries. This is a story with so many layers of tragedy that it's hard to quite know where to start. A gunman entered a bar with the intent to kill people. Let's just start there. That individual was wounded by a security guard who then subdued him and held him at gunpoint awaiting the arrival of the police. And this is where we have to talk about adrenaline, and we have to talk about self-control, and we have to talk about snap judgments, and we have to talk about racial bias, and we have to talk about the assumptions that we make in less than a split second, because that's what happened. In less than a split second, an officer drew his weapon and shot a black man who had a gun in another person's back, and that person, you know, was lying on the ground. So I want to pause and actually encourage us to consider for a moment how long you think it takes to judge a situation, judge an individual, judge what's happening, and then, you know, our response is guided and driven by those literal, what are called snap judgments. So the Journal of Psychological Science says that you and I categorize or judge an object literally the moment we perceive it. And so they don't really have, this isn't like a tenth of a second or a hundredth of a second. This is like a thousandth of a second. Like, literally, it does not even take us a blink of an eye to know that something is a tree or a cow or a rainbow. It just doesn't. It doesn't. It's instantaneous. We make those judgments of categorization instantaneously. Other judgments about people and what we think we know about them take longer to form. My mom actually used to say people made 10 judgments about the other person in the first 10 seconds. And that may have been true a generation ago, but now, research that the most recent research that I could find is already 10 years old. And it indicates that most of our judgments happen within the first second. In fact, our initial judgment happens in the first 1/10 of the first second. So in the first 1/10 of 1 second, you and I make a judgment, make one particular judgment that is critical here. And it is the judgment of trustworthiness. In the first 1/10 of the first second that you see someone, you have already judged whether or not they are trustworthy. Now, that is not a lot of time. You literally do not even get a full second to make a first impression. There were a series of experiments done by Princeton psychologists, Janine Willis and Alexander Todorov, that reveal that it takes 1/10 of a second to form an impression of a stranger, and that we do so based on their face and their race. It takes longer exposure if we're going to have those initial ideas or thoughts actually altered. It takes a lot longer period of time because we have confidence in our own first judgment. Like we place immediate confidence in the judgment that we make of another person in the first 1/10 of the first second. If you want to read about this, it's in the July 2006 issue of Psychological Science in an article entitled First Impressions. They say in that article, like it or not, judgments based on appearance play a powerful role in how we treat others and how we get treated. Psychologists have long known that attractive people, however you want to define that term, get better outcomes in practically all walks of life and in practically every environment. People whose faces we judge to be mature receive more severe judicial outcomes than people who are considered to be baby-faced. And having a face that looks competent as opposed to trustworthy or likable may matter a lot whether or not a person gets elected to public office. So there's actually, like, apparently a look of competence. So you can read the rest of the research, but in here, they were shown faces for 100 milliseconds. That's 1/10 of a second. And then they were shown faces for half a second. And then they were shown faces for a full second. And they were asked to judge the faces for a trait in question. And the trait in question would be, is the person competent? Or the trait in question would be, is the person trustworthy? And the reality is, you and I make our fastest snap judgment in that first 1/10 of the first second on the question of trustworthiness. The second judgment we make is on the subject or on the trait of attractiveness. So if you are an evolutionary psychologist, then you go, aha, those are both tied to survival. Whether or not you are trustworthy is a literal life or death decision that an animal has to make in the wild. And so if you are operating from a secular or naturalistic Darwinian worldview, then you are going to say to yourself, well, of course, we make a trustworthiness judgment almost instantaneously, because in the wild, as animals, our life depends on it. Do you see here how worldview matters? And do you see here how worldview matters in terms of the way we train our own brains and train ourselves culturally on the subject of trustworthiness and who is and isn't trustworthy based on, I don't know, the color of their skin, the shape of their face, other physical attributes. The second attribute that they say we make in the snap judgment category is attractiveness, which, of course, evolutionary psychologists say is tied to someone's, you know, desire to have progeny, to procreate. So for those of us who know that secular, naturalistic, Darwinian worldview is wrong, and that people are made on purpose and for a purpose in the image of a living God, we have to enter into this conversation and we have to say, okay, we got to retrain the brain. We have to actually, from the very beginning, we have to train ourselves and others to recognize the genuine humanity of other people. We've got a testimony that needs to get out there in the culture. It needs to get some traction in the racial conversations of our day. There's going to be plenty of blame casting in the situation in Chicago. And you and I need to be proclaiming over and over and over again that no matter the color of another person's skin, no matter the nation of their birth, no matter the circumstances of their life, people are in fact image bearers of the living God. Now, some of them behave in ways that are reprehensible, and that's why we have law enforcement. Absolutely. And that gets us into this conversation that the officer in this case must be held accountable for his actions. I think there's no question about that. But as Christians, the point of entry into the conversation and the points that we need to be seeking to gain traction on is a conversation about race. And it's a conversation about snap judgments based on race. And we could call that prejudice, like prejudging someone because of the color of their skin. You and I need to keep reminding ourselves and everyone else that as image bearers of the living God, regardless of the color of our skin, or any other factors like the nation of our birth or the tone of the accent of our voice, that we have equal dignity at creation. And we have equal standing or equal footing at the cross as sinners in need of salvation. And for those who put their trust in Jesus Christ, we have equal status, equal standing in the kingdom of God. So I'm going to invite us to resist the false choice that is going to be demanded by some who are going to require us to either support those in law enforcement or advocate for change while mourning over a victim. I believe we can and must do both. The Bible commands us to weep with those who weep and give honor where it is due. It also demands that we fight for justice and pursue after righteousness. And so let's start with checking our own bias today. Let's not degrade anyone, and let's seek to fully love others, and let's do so by really advancing the conversation about race and injustice and snap judgments and prejudice and bias, not only in our culture but in our hearts. All right, friends, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, I've got more headlines for you. I am Carmen LaBurge, and you are listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. You can communicate with me via email. I'm Carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @CarmenLaBurge. Thank you to all of you who have been giving such great listener feedback over the last few days. And I love it. You do it either by text, which is 877-933-2484. You do it by email. I appreciate the emails that I've gotten in the last couple of days, particularly in response to another person's email who I read yesterday. Like, that's great. Like, that's really appreciated. And I like to know what you're thinking and how you're responding to what you're hearing here and how you're using it. So if what we're talking about here makes its way into the conversations that you are having, I'd love to hear about that. So again, you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. So there's been this ongoing, I don't even really have a word for it. There's not a great relationship between the President of the United States and what we would call the press corps. And it's not everybody in the press corps. It seems to be selected individuals and selected news outlets that the president doesn't like. And he makes that very public. I mean, there's no secret to any of this. But that kind of all came to a head a few days ago. And so let me brief you in on this story in case it's one that you're not following. CNN filed a lawsuit Tuesday against the Trump administration in federal court demanding that the White House return correspondent Jim Acosta's press credentials. Those would be his White House press credentials, which gives him the ability to enter the White House and cover the president and everything else that happens there. Other news outlets, including Fox, are actually filing amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, in support of CNN. So these journalistic outlets, agencies, media companies, however you want to think about it, they are arguing the wrongful revocation of Jim Acosta's credentials violate CNN and Acosta's First Amendment rights of freedom of the press and their Fifth Amendment right to due process. The administration, if you have seen the video of a heated exchange between Jim Acosta and President Trump during a White House news conference in which the president was trying to move on from a question that Jim Acosta was asking. Jim Acosta refused to give up the microphone, and the president then called him a rude and terrible person. It's a longer exchange than that. There's a little more to it than that. But suffice it to say, Jim Acosta chose to behave in a way that is contrary to sort of the agreed upon rules of a White House press briefing, certainly one that includes the president. And the president responded in a way that we might recognize was also not great. Sort of searching for a word there. So the administration pulled Acosta's press credentials last week, and the administration is defending its right to grant press access to the White House and to the president. So I actually think, like, right, I could reasonably argue either side of this case. I could reasonably argue that, yes, in fact, the president and the White House administration absolutely has every right and authority to limit access to the president and or the White House in any way they want. Like, I get that. It's being in the House is by invitation only. And so, you know, folks ought to behave there in ways that are honoring of the president or honoring of the presidency, even if they don't like the current person in that position. There's also supposed to be this sort of way of operating in terms of members of the journalistic press corps, that they're not actually there to make the news. They're not actually there to become the news. They're there to report on the news. And so in that spirit, it does seem as if Jim Acosta has been increasingly seeking a public fight with the president. He has been choosing to behave in ways that have escalated over time. And it did seem as if he was not going to give up that microphone until he had the president saying something on record directly to him that would be, that would land us in the kind of situation that we're in right now. So, as you might expect, there have been all kinds of responses. Responses vary across a wide spectrum here. I'm going to read two. Legendary reporter Bob Woodward, he told audiences that, quote, in the news media, there has been an emotional reaction to Trump. Too many people for Trump or against Trump have become emotionally unhinged. Now, he's referring there to members of the news media. That is a problem. They are supposed to be unbiased. You know, they're just supposed to deliver news and information. And that's clearly not what's going on anymore. On the other side, former CBS News anchor Dan Rather said, quote, news the White House pulled Jim Acosta's credentials is not an attack on one journalist, but on all of the press. So I think personally what makes me feel sad is that we've arrived at this particular point. Our public discourse has devolved and degraded to the point where taking one another to court seems the only way, as if there's no one who is able, is wise enough to settle a dispute. That brings to mind 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 to 8. Now, I recognize that this is directed, this is a text directed to Christians about taking one another as individuals to court. But you might recall that that Paul is encouraging the church at Corinth to refrain from taking fellow Christians to court. Now, part of that is putting the business of Christians in front of a secular court. That's a problem there. But his question in verse 5, I think, helps us here. And again, this is from 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And so if you look at verse 5, there's this question. Is there no one among you that's wise enough to settle a dispute between the brothers? You got to take it to court? So you may disagree with Acosta's tactics. You may disagree with the president or the administration's position. But I think we should admit that no one really here is behaving in a way that we would want our children to emulate. And so in your conversations about this, you know, maybe each of us needs to be clear. The press is not the enemy of the people, nor is the president, the Antichrist. What then is the way forward? Well, by his grace, God provides in his word some excellent reminders of a way forward when we disagree with one another. And Jesus's words here instruction in Matthew chapter 18, I think is important to revisit. So these are the words of Jesus recorded by Matthew in chapter 18. I'm going to pick up at verse 15, read five verses. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you've won your brother. If he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that that by the words of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. If he refuses to listen to them, then tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, then let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. That would be somebody that is outside of the fellowship. Truly, I say to you, whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. Again, I say to you, if two of you agree on earth about anything that that you may ask, it shall be done for them by my Father who is in heaven. For where two or three have gathered together in my name, I am there in their midst. Now, my guess is that many people do not recognize the context of that last statement, that where two or three gather together in my name, I will be in their midst. Don't recognize that the context of that is this conversation about the resolution of disagreement, the resolution of having one person having sinned against another. So conversations you could have here, because this is a question of if your brother sins, there's a question of who is my brother and what responsibility do I have for him. That takes us all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. What constitutes a fault? Show him his fault in private. What constitutes a fault? How do I know if he's really heard me? Because there's a question here about if he listens to you, then you have won your brother. Or if he listens to the two or three, then you have won your brother. And then I think that, you know, it's good for all of us to consider who are the two or three that I might take with me into a conversation if I genuinely have a disagreement with someone else. If there's sin that needs to be confronted, if there's a breach that needs to be bridged with another believer or with somebody about whom I care, who might I take with me into those conversations? And then look at the power of agreement at the end of this text. If two of you agree on earth about anything, then it's going to be done. And so agreement is what is highlighted here, not disagreement. All right, friends, up next, I'm going to be talking with Paul Coughlin. He and I are going to talk about his new book, Free Us from Bullying. Paul and I are going to talk about the reality that much of what we believe about bullying in our culture today is actually not accurate. And he's also going to help us understand how to become advocates for those who are bullied. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we'll be right back.
So if I stand, let me stand on the promise. You will pull me through. And if I can't.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined in conversation now by Paul Coughlin. Paul is the founder and president of The Protectors. It's an official ministry partner of the Association of Christian Schools International, working to reduce adolescent and workplace bullying. He has helped thousands of children apologize for bullying during his Courage to Be Kind presentations. Paul is a former newspaper editor. His writing has appeared in numerous media outlets. And the book that we're going to be talking about today is Free Us from Bullying, Real Solutions Beyond Being Nice. Paul Coughlin, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
So this book opens with a heartbreaking story. But I think we better set the stage for the conversation today by having you describe the nature and scope of bullying in the culture. And then if you want to tell Alex Moore's story, I would invite you to do that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, we're familiar with the statistic that 160,000 kids stay home from school each day due to bullying. That's about 13 million a year. That stat comes from the middle 1990s, before cyberbullying was even a word. So that number of kids who are being bullied is in the millions, and it is the leading form of child abuse in the nation and most likely the world. So it is huge. Most every child is affected by it, not just targets, but bystanders, because bystanders are harmed as well when they witness it. Their test scores, for example, go down. Alex Moore was a beautiful young lady there in Jamison, Alabama. And what happened to her was so extremely sad. And there's so many stories that we can pull from that. She did commit what we call bullycide. She jumped off of an overpass, sadly. But the one thing I wanted to point out with her story was that if someone had stood up for her, statistically, even one person, it could have fundamentally changed her life, because the power of the bystander when they become what we call a protector is so profound and so life-changing. Not only can it literally save the life of another kid, it changes the life of the person who becomes that protector. They become a bigger, stronger person. They become more Christ-like.
So one of the things I really appreciate about what you have done here is that you do help us see and understand what I would describe as kind of the array of characters involved. There is a victim of bullying. There is a bully. There are witnesses or bystanders. Those people can be equipped to become protectors. Bullies can be an intervention can happen with them. They can be confronted. And things can change. So I would like to talk about some of the people in this sort of range of folks involved, because I think we tend to think of bullying as, first of all, a school problem. You completely dissuade us of that and help us recognize that this is a culture problem. But there are lots of other misconceptions about bullying that you expose here. So why don't you talk a little bit about some of the misconceptions that we have about bullying today?
Yeah, there's so many of them. One is that it makes us stronger. Particularly, you'll hear this from men more than women during my community presentations. They'll say things like, "That which doesn't kill us makes us stronger." They think they're quoting the Bible. That's not. That's Friedrich Nietzsche, who hated the Bible and who also said man is the cruelest of all beasts. It doesn't make us stronger. Some people never fully recover. And as you know, Carmen, in the book, there's a great interview with Frank Peretti. Many of your listeners are familiar with Frank. And he writes about what it did to him well into adulthood, the bullying that he experienced. He said it devastated him. He said it made him a wreck in many ways. And I encourage people to take a look at that, because it really, really breaks through. Another misconception we have about bullying is that the bully feels badly about himself or herself, that they have low self-esteem. That has been challenged since the early 70s, and it's gotten worse and worse, I think, in a good way, where more and more research is showing that bullies do not have low self-esteem. Bullies have excessive self-esteem. It is arrogance, it's pride, it's hubris. It is believing that you are more important than others that causes most kids to bully most of the time.
Hey, friends, my conversation partner today is Paul Coughlin. We are going to invite you to check out The Protectors at theprotectors.org. You can also connect with them on Facebook. And we do have books available today. So if this is a subject matter that is important to you and close to your heart, and you would like to enter the drawing for one of our copies of Free Us from Bullying, Real Solutions Beyond Being Nice, you can text us at 877-933-2484, or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Paul, one of the words that you used there a minute ago, and I know it's from Nietzsche, but I'm going to use it here as a stepping off point for a conversation about bullies, particularly serial bullies, because it's the word beasts. This is very Darwinian. One of the words that I wrote in the margin, see if I could, you know, this is where can I find in the book where I wrote something? Maybe not. But it was definitely in one of the paragraphs where you're talking about the serial bully or the bully and how they feel about themselves. And you use this very powerful language about it's not just that they have self-esteem. They actually like enjoy what they're doing. They enjoy the pain they're inflicting, and they actually don't see themselves as the problem. They see that victim, that wounded person, that weak person as the problem. The target is viewed as them, viewed by them as someone they're actually in the world to destroy. I mean, talk with us a little bit about what's going on in the mind and the heart of the bully.
Yeah, there's studies that will tell us that a bully actually, well, they certainly believe that the target deserves the treatment for fill in the blank, the color of their skin, the way they walk. They might be socially awkward. They don't like the shape of their ears. Honestly, this is how they will dial in on someone to make their life absolutely miserable. Keep in mind that a bully is not looking for a fight. A bully wants to overwhelm. So they only pick on certain kids and not others. And the other thing about it, you know, I think if we were honest too, and I've had to become honest on this topic, is that if we all look back on our lives, particularly in school, if we're honest, many of us did experiment with bullying. I know I did. I went after a young lady who had brain surgery when I was in elementary school, and I used to defend her. Her name was Tammy. And one day, I don't know what got into me. I went after her, and I called her a name the way I'd seen my classmates. So, you know, many people have experience with it, and I think we need to be honest. It's pleasurable. Bully, why do bullies bully? Because they can. But then also, most importantly, because they can. We have to make the situation, the environment, to where it's not conducive to bullying. Well, they actually enjoy harming other people. And I just gave you the definition of sadism. So when you said earlier it's very beast-like, it really is beast-like. It represents the worst in human nature. It represents what the medievals called Capiticus, the sin of Capiticus, or the sin of the wolf. Dante writes about this. And this is where people are only valuable in as much as they can be bartered. They can be consumed. So what do bullies barter? Bullies barter the value and dignity of other people for social gain, particularly during the school years. So it really does stem from profound, spiritually dark things. But fighting it, combating it, represents the best in human nature as well.
Friends, my conversation partner is Paul Coughlin. The book that discussing today is Free Us from Bullying, Real Solutions Beyond Being Nice. We do have copies available. If you are interested and would like to enter the drawing for one of those, you can text me at 877-933-2484. You can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. If you would like to connect with Paul, you can do so at theprotectors.org. That's online, or on the Protectors Facebook page. Paul, let's talk about the transformation that needs to take place, both in the bully and the confrontation that's required in order for that transformation to take place. And then let's also talk about how a witness can become a protector.
Yeah, one thing, I really have such a heart for targets. In fact, earlier today I spoke with the mother of a young man who had been a target for a long time. And we believe in what we call hardening the target, resistance without war. Again, a bully is not looking for a fight. A bully wants to overwhelm. And sadly, Carmen, many bullies focus in on that nice Christian kid, that kid who has been taught not to push back, that kid whose parents don't believe in any form of force at all. That kid, and I just wrote an article for ACSI, Association of Christian Schools International, that kid has been told to turn the other cheek. Carmen, if our listeners remember nothing else, I hope they remember this, that turn the other cheek has nothing to do at all with a fourth grader being bullied in a school or for any kid being bullied. To put it in context, it has to do with having a generous spirit. That's what Jesus says at the very end of that pivotal and somewhat cryptic form of the part of scripture there. So sadly, they go after the nice kid. So what do we do there? We have to help that target appear less attractive. We have to give them a verbal comeback. Parents will say things, well, don't say anything back because you'll lower yourself to their level. Well, many parents have no idea what they're talking about when it comes to bullying, because sometimes not responding to the bully says, oh, they're not going to respond. I can go after them even more. So we believe in a force of in a show of strength, but not violence when dealing with a bully. One of the things they can do is say whatever. Whatever is dismissive, but it's not an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. It doesn't get into revenge. But not just what the child says, it's how they say it. They need to say it as if it doesn't bother them. Even when it does, say it as if it doesn't bother them, and then move out of what we call the theater of bullying. Why is that important? Because many bullies have superior verbal acumen. They're better with words, and they know it. And so what they want to do is they want to tie up that poor kid in this ongoing conversation so they can continue to verbally abuse that kid. Don't let it happen. Patton said, do not let the enemy choose the battlefield. If at all possible, as a target of bullying, don't let them do that. Have more assertive body language. Studies show that we communicate mostly through body language, and bullies really key in on that. They look for that kid who's uncomfortable, who has weak body language. We train kids how to have assertive body language. And then friendships, really important. 3 to 5 friends, far less likely to be bullied. How do we transform a bully? We got to get our hands on them earlier than later. We have to help them become honest that they often bear false witness against other kids. They often lie. You know the behaviors in Scripture, that 7 behaviors that God finds detestable? Every one of those behaviors found in the Psalms have to do with bullying as well. So we need to put up the mirror of reality to their behavior, and hopefully we can change it, because as I think the listeners have been able to figure out by now, this is really criminal behavior in a very young body. A serial bully is 4 to 5 times more likely to commit a felony by their early 20s. And then most importantly, that bystander. Studies show they want to help the target, but they're too afraid. So we need to change our family values. We need to include in our dinner time conversations as a family, if you witness someone being bullied, you will do something pro-social. You can intervene right away. You can comfort the target afterward, or you can report, not tattle, to authority what you saw and what you heard. I believe we have settled for low-grade goodness as Christians in regard to parenting, for niceties. But what about justice? What about standing up for other people? We should be doing that, and that starts with parents. It doesn't start with teachers.
Paul, I learned a lot reading between the lines of some of the conversations that you had with others. I really felt like in reading Frank Peretti's conversation with you that, man, there's some really subtle stuff that goes on that adults are responsible for, that we have passed off in our culture as, it's either we think of it as funny, or we think of it as, as a good way to encourage boys to become men. And yeah, it is not only bullying, it trains up a whole new generation of bullies. And so I also felt like there were some things in this book. And again, friends, the book is Free Us from Bullying, Real Solutions Beyond Being Nice. Paul Coughlin is the author. The website is theprotectors.org. There were things in here, Paul, that as I was reading, some things that I had not seen. I just hadn't seen them. You brought them to light. And some of it, frankly, are things that happen in the church. Some of it are things that have happened right in front of me in relationship to adults, right? Where there are some bullying behaviors that people have been allowed to continue over time. And some of those people end up in very powerful positions in ministry. So there were lots of places in here where I thought to myself, yes, this is about kids, but this is about the family of faith and what's going on in the church as well. So again, it was a great education for me to read the book.
Well, thank you. And yeah, I mean, there was a very popular pastor a number of years ago. It got taken down mostly due to bullying. And you know, there's an interview in there about the need for humility. How do you transform a bully? They need greater humility. The problem is they don't think they do. And when they're in power, they just brush that stuff off. It's below them. And I have an interview in the book with someone who, what he does is he tries to help pastors who have fallen. And he says something pretty profound. He says, you know, there's always been bullying among leadership in Christian churches in America. He said, but what happened in that most recent one a few years ago out of Seattle would be that now, finally, a pastor can be taken down because of it. To which I would say, you know, we often look at infidelity, for example, as the sometimes almost the only reason why a pastor might have to step down. When it comes to bullying, Carmen, bullying affects far more people because bullies don't dial in on just one person. They dial in on multiple people. So now you have multiple people whose lives are really being crushed. And then what about their families? The domino effect of bullying from leadership within the church is far more damaging than infidelity in most cases, most of the time.
All right, Paul, we're going to have to leave it right there. Again, friends, the book is Free Us from Bullying. If you want more information, you can visit The Protectors on either Facebook or theprotectors.org online. If you would like to enter a drawing for a copy of one of the books we have here in studio, you can text me, 877-933-2484, or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Paul Coughlin, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Hey, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We are going to make the connecting point. Hey, I was reminded during my conversation there with Paul Coughlin about bullying. I was reminded of the conversation that we had here on Connecting Faith with Chloe Howard. Do you remember her? We had her on the 20th of July. Her book is entitled Stand Beautiful. Chloe was born with a terribly deformed foot. She had lots of, you know, surgeries over the course of her life, and she, you know, she was bullied, actually, you know, assaulted at school, at a Christian school, due to her deformity. I don't know if you remember that conversation, but her powerful testimony is really incredible. She's got a great TED Talk. If you just wanted to Google her, Chloe Howard. If you want to go back and grab the podcast, you can do so at myfaithradio.com or at reconnectwithcarmen.com. In either place, if you just type in Chloe Howard, our 720 interview with Chloe will come up. And again, that was, she's an inspiration, and she is a wonderful advocate for kids like herself. So I want to, in the connecting point today, this might be a little strange connecting point. You're going to say to yourself, this is just clearly something Carmen wants to talk about. So there you go. The connecting point today is something Carmen wants to talk about. And it's about Stan Lee. I don't know if you know who that is or have heard that name, but you definitely know the characters who Stan Lee created. So Stan Lee is the legendary Marvel Comics creator. He recently died at the age of 95. And so there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of news headlines out there about him, lots of coverage, lots of obituaries, lots of folks talking about the impact that he had on their life. So he was born Stanley Martin Lieber in New York City. He co-created Spider-Man, the Hulk, the Avengers, the X-Men, the Fantastic Four, Black Panther, Daredevil, Doctor Strange, and a host of other heroes. While he was working as a writer and then editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. So you certainly recognize the characters, right? What you may not know is that Stan Lee, he started to call the those who became what I will just describe as the Marvel Comics tribe, those folks who you and I might think of as like Comic-Con people, he started referring to them with a specific designation. He called them the true believers. And he would call the true believers to stand, and he would call the true believers to face forward, and he would call the true believers. And it's interesting language, is it not? Stan Lee clearly knew that he had imagined these characters. He had written them. He had written their backstories. He had written vulnerabilities into their characters because he recognized that that made them three-dimensional. Otherwise, they're flat. In order to make them seem more real, he gave them genuinely human characteristics, which includes vulnerabilities. He gave them a past. He described a future. In the comic world that Stan Lee really created, I mean, he really is the creator of this entire genre. I mean, I say that. Now, truth be told, if you look back and you read sort of Greek myths and you read Roman mythology, you're going to say to yourself, these kinds of characters certainly existed in other stories, in other storylines, in other meta-narratives, because people were trying to explain reality, and they were trying to explain events in history, and they were trying to explain why things happened. And so they came up with these stories that included these characters, sometimes functioned as gods, but were clearly capricious and fallen, and in some cases, half-human or human-esque. And so, you know, when I say Stan Lee created all of these, you know, there's certainly a genre, if you go far enough back in Greek mythology and Roman understanding of the gods, that you're going to find some of these characters there as well. So, but in terms of creating a comic type hero that was accessible and believable to 21st century Americans, people were looking for saviors. They were looking to the sky. They were looking for ways to have evil defeated, for there to be someone who would rise up and be good and do good, even if they were at some level flawed and broken. And Stan Lee would say, all the better that they be somewhat flawed and broken, because it made them more believable. So I think that in terms of the conversations that we can have as Christians, there are lots of conversations that the death of Stan Lee raises up. What do people actually believe in? Are people looking for a savior? What is it about having a hero that attracts us? And if we really do believe that for these devotees of the comic world, that frankly, one of their gods has now died, this is actually an opportunity for us to, you know, to engage and talk about the best story and the best character and the real savior and the real hero, and to invite people to look to Christ and look for Christ. And so Stan Lee was a great storyteller, and he was great at developing characters. Well, we have a God who has the most extraordinary, well-developed character ever. And we have his story, history, and we can talk about how he has engaged in human history to deliver people and bring redemption. That is the story that you and I have to be passionate about. We have to be the true believers in the real character of the real God who is actually unfolding in the course of human history, real redemption, real salvation, bringing genuine good up against genuine evil. All right, friends, we are out of time here on Connecting Faith. I have enjoyed my time with you. Hopefully you have enjoyed your time as well. Let me hear your feedback. You can reach me on Twitter at Carmen LaBurge. You can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can visit my ministry website, reconnectwithcarmen.com, and you can always find me at My Faith Radio. All right, friends, have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.